This is CliffCentral.com.
From the moment I stepped in the room, it was clear from the 300 women, I wasn't welcome. You see, I'm not a paranoid type person who thinks everyone looking in my direction is staring at me, or that every whisper is meant to conceal something from my ears. But the collective gulp that came over the room as their heads turned towards me as I stepped through the main event's door was the surest sign that it may be a good idea for me to turn around and leave without giving my speech. The major corporate company who organized the event had a booth set up outside, and it was one of their employees who ushered me in and sat me down. This large insurance company needed a speaker to speak in 8 cities across South Africa. Durban and Cape Town had gone really well, but this was Pretoria. The insurer wanted me to speak to each audience about the same thing, about the relationship between insurance and their personal brand legacy. While each event had a different audience, the theme and the message was the same. The audience should consider this insurer to secure their future, hoping they'll leave the most impactful legacy with the partnership. On this night, 100% of the women were white Afrikaans. The entire event, in fact, was in Afrikaans. The only reason I knew it was time for me to speak, I heard my name. As I heard my name, I walked through the audience, past about 3 tables before stepping on the stage. I clear my throat. I greet. Good evening. One person claps. What happened next is remarkable. After my talk, 3 women asked if I was single because they wanted me to meet their daughter. You see, I'm not the Denzel type, so I know for a fact it wasn't because of how I looked. What I did, though, I used laughter to neutralize the tension, and we connected on a level that transcends gender, class, and yes, race. Welcome back to the next episode of the Brain and Brand Show. I am your host, Timothy Maurice, and this is the show where we explore brain and brand behavior, how people impact brands and brands and story impact our psyche. Today, we explore how laughter can be used to connect you with others, a tool. I take you back to a conversation I had with 2-time Emmy-nominated comedian Luis Ogola, who is now has a residence in the UK. We explore the techniques and tools he used to connect with audiences around the world. Audiences who are a million worlds removed from the township he grew up in, just outside Cape Town's city center, a little township called Guguletu. Seeing the world react and respond to your comedy, I thought it was really interesting. There was one skit, I think you were in Edinburgh somewhere.
Yeah.
And the audience act like you were their boy. That's what I found interesting.
Yeah, but that you create that.
Okay.
You they don't act like they're everyone's boy. You there's a way to get them on your side.
Sure.
And it's like a comedy thing sometimes when you're on stage and you purposefully isolate the audience to make them feel specific things. So when you do stand up, there's certain words that we use that is inclusive to the audience. We.
Sure.
You say, oh, so we, or you could go, when you say I, you isolate them. You say I, then they go, oh, okay, that's you. If you say, oh, we should, we, do you, ooh, and then it, you know what,
yes.
I mean? Those are some of the
so that's what I love about
tricks.
You guys. People don't understand. This is a skill. You guys are professionals, grown people on stage. You're not just up talking.
We're not 3-year-olds spinning.
And that's the beauty. So that's why I wanted to have this conversation, because comedy is a social tool. And what I'm really fascinated by
is you guys have most of the top comedians, like millions of followers. You know, I'm sure if you collect all of your Snapchat, your Instagram, your Twitter, you've got well over a million people who are hanging out with you.
Right.
Are people trying to escape pain? Is that why you guys have such large following?
I think people are trying to escape pain, but I think people get a lot of the escaping from pain with music. I think music allows them to get away. I think though, with comedy, I was actually having this discussion with someone. I was saying that the humor in South Africa, it has a lot to do with resonance.
Yeah.
I think like the more people resonate with you, the better. So the more you are like really approachable on stage, the more people are going to gravitate towards you. So people do to a large extent want to escape. Like for instance, in like New York, like if I think of the New York comedy scene, man, I go, okay, Brooke, there's so many scenes. There's the black scene.
Yeah, yeah.
There's like the cellar, which is like a regular working class. It's like your regular human being. And then you have like an art scene. Mm-hmm. Now these clubs or these performing spaces are about, I don't know, maybe 4 kilometers away from each other. Completely. But the audiences are completely different. So wow. You constantly have to adjust. So as much as the people want to escape from whatever issue or problem and free their minds and think of something else, they all expect different things, right? Like okay. The art crowd, and there's this gig in New York. It's on a Monday, first of all, and it starts at 11 in the evening. Okay. And it's called UCB.
UCB, yeah.
It's a UCB, UCB Chelsea.
Yeah,
right,
Chelsea.
And it's like an arty gig. You tell stories, you get involved, and there's a gig on Monday as well, just before that one, which starts at about 9. So I usually go that gig and then go to the UCB one. It's in it's a Sinak Wyatt gig.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's got a gig in Brooklyn called
from
Nitrate.
From the Daily Show.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. When Jon Stewart, and he has a show. And these are like storytelling shows. And then you go uptown to the Stand.
Okay.
And it's like the people are like, don't tell us about sandwiches and ninjas.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell
yeah.
us about okay. we want jokes, punchy, punchy. So it's what I'm trying to say is that people, you have to, and for us. For me as a South African, I find it, a lot of American acts, like if a guy comes from Chicago into New York, he struggles to adapt his act to the various audiences. Now I go, in South Africa, we've been trained for that because we have 11 different
life.
Languages.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you have to tap into the nuances of all those languages. Because the guy was like, how do you just plug in? I said, no, because we constantly, if I'm in Bloom, I'm very different from when I'm in Polokwane.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm very different from when I'm in Maritzburg. I'm very, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
I can't take a joke from KwaZulu-Natal and take it to Cape Town as it is. I got to patch it up.
Yeah, I'm with you. But in many ways, that's a strength and it could also be a weakness, right? So you look at someone like Kevin Hart, he's right. not trying to adjust. He is one, like even in every film, he's the same dude.
Well, he's found the thing that makes him funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah.
But his funny is very universal. I think there's certain acts who just have a universal funny, and anyone can sort of plug into them. And I think sure. Kevin Hart is one of them.
Yeah.
I think Trevor's one of those acts. Russell Peters is one of those acts. There's some acts where they have to have their specific audience.
They
like,
sort of rise above the diversity issue with their uniqueness.
Yeah, yeah. So okay. I'm trying to think of a musical act that, like Adele.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, Adele yeah. just has a, I mean,
she's talking about chasing pavements. Everybody can relate to that.
Boom.
Yeah.
There we go. And then you get like acts like Hannibal Buress, who's like a very specific act
yeah.
who has his own you know, who, and the specific acts have a tendency to grow their own audiences in a strange way, because they have to find these people from all over the place.
Got it. What did it help you growing up in Google to Cape Town, your Cape Town sort of roots, and dealing with, you know, in fact, at what point was it where you realized that you can translate well to different audiences?
I haven't lived in Google in a long time, so I don't know how much of that experience I still draw from. But I do, I think from a very young age, found that just being pure honest about any situation translates to funny. I just do know.
Just raw honesty.
Well, not necessarily raw, just the, if something is going wrong, and we go, oh, well, that's not going well. I think I remember the first time, where I was like, okay, this is kind of a thing. We were playing cricket, and we were all there, and we had these exchange students who were coaching us, and they were from Britain, and we huddled up, and we were getting killed. I said, we're getting killed. And everyone in the just laughed, and I was like, yeah, there's no, before we talk tactics and da 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 da, can we just acknowledge that right now we're getting killed? And the guy said that everyone just killed themselves, and then we composed ourselves, and then we, because in order for you to, it's like if you, in order for you to enjoy the moment, you have to acknowledge that, listen, this is not what we planned, it's not going well. And then everyone goes, oh yeah, okay, cool, that's off my shoulders. And I think like that's a trick with humor that you are.
But it's
tricky because you have to, that honesty has to have a certain tone. Like you can't have a discouraging tone. Mm. It has to be a very pure acknowledgement tone. It has to just be like, well, I'm acknowledging the thing so that everyone feels comfortable to move forward. But I'm not going, oh, we're not going to come back. Or I just have to say, hey, this is a bit of a situation.
It's like when Chris Rock came out on the Oscars and says, you know, welcome to the White People's Choice Award or whatever.
Right.
Is that what he was doing?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's off the bat, there's this inverted commas controversy. I don't like using the word controversy because it just gets overused and it sometimes is misrepresented. But it was there was the talk of the boycotts and the Emmys are too white and that. So that's the issue at hand. So before we move on to whatever we're going to talk about, can we just acknowledge that and get that out the way? Package it, put it on top. This is. Okay, cool. We got that out the way, and then we move on. So it's like a trick. So it's like doing a corporate function for a big company, and let's say you read up on if I did a gig for Edcon or something, and you just read about them being 800 million in the red. That's the first thing you're gonna talk about. So.
Got it.
So, you guys are not doing well.
Yeah.
Good thing I got my money in advance.
Got it.
So, it's like, you know, whatever bank you go, you guys were in trouble in the papers. Whatever the case is, get out the way.
You know who gave me that advice once at a Vodacom gig, and I didn't listen, and I failed. It's one of the worst gigs I've ever had in my life. It's David Kabuka. He was emceeing. Came back on stage and he was like, dude, this is a tough crowd. He's like, when you get out there, the first thing you better do is acknowledge this energy. Yeah. And I thought I knew better. Dude, I was sweating. He looked at me like, you're not serious.
you gotta acknowledge. You gotta, every situation has to, it's so crazy. So we were, the last time I did this thing publicly, and it was the Kanye West concert. So it was me, Gareth, and Pearl Tusi were hosting the thing. It was,
okay.
It was a big sponsor when Kanye played at the Dome. And Kanye was just like late, you know. And we were chilling backstage. And his change room was on the other side. And people like, and the crowd is getting quite restless because they've been there at 5. It's 11, Kanye hasn't jumped on. And we bantering with the crowd. So what happens is, the people start booing Pearl. Where's Kanye? Boo, we don't want to. And then I was like, this is not fair on her because, you know, she's got nothing to do with this. She's just caught up in the crossfire. So when I come out, I go, guys, you paid. You're not going to leave. Just hang 10. Kanye is coming. Mm-hmm. It's not like now. Just calm down. What are you going to do? Go home. You paid. You're here. You got dressed. Da, da, da. So I was acknowledging, listen, we're all in this together. I'm not Kanye's friend. I'm not Kanye's manager. There's nothing I can do.
Yeah,
you know
yeah.
what I mean? Kanye is going to come out when Kanye comes out. Like, you act like you've not seen the crazy things this guy does on TV. Now you want him to be here on time, please. And so they all I come back. I'm like, oh man, how did you survive that brutal crowd? I was like, 'cause I just told them this is what's happening.
Got it.
And then so it's like, so with comedy, you learn these tricks. But here's the thing I hate about comedy, especially hanging out with comedians. There's this trick of trying to turn conversations into if you ever have a very serious conversation with a comedian and he's and you're making a better point, he'll turn it into a funny situation. And you're like, no. No. This is a very serious conversation.
Yeah.
Let's keep it there. And that's a trick that comics use. They're able to maneuver through life and through society, even like just in dialogue and just interactions with humor. I know exactly when to switch it on. I just go, okay, boom, and then I'm out of that situation. I mean, I can't really give an example now. So I really hate it when I spot someone doing that to me.
Got
I go, hey, listen, man, we were talking about Fees Must Fall. Now you're talking about it. You know what I mean?
Got it. Your late night work, obviously it was celebrated by a lot of people. And I'm sure you can relate to what Trevor Noah is going through and the pressure that's placed on it and for people to actually learn, because people look to you guys for a rational voice and logic and in the middle of your satires trying to find, you know, something that makes sense. How well do you think he's doing? You've actually visited him. You guys are friends. You've went to his show. What are your thoughts on how well he's doing?
I think he's doing very well, considering the circumstances. And when I say considering the circumstances, I mean to inherit such a big show. It's like if anyone took over. It's like it happened with Piers Morgan when he took over Larry King's spot. It was just a difficult thing This is the cultural relevance of the show, and it means a specific thing to a specific person. So when you hand it over to someone else, they trying to make it their own thing. And
is it like Tabo and Vega taking over from Madiba?
Yeah, and then the people are like, oh, this statesman is not as friendly. And then you're like, it's not the same thing, you know. So, but I think he's done well in trying to stamp his own identity on the show. But the thing with these shows, it takes a very long time to get your rhythm going. I mean, Seinfeld ran for about 12 seasons.
Yeah.
They only started... getting their rhythm right on halfway through, which was the sixth season.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it takes forever, right? And that was a huge sitcom. And same with Jon Stewart. It probably took him like 5-6 years to get his feet, and then you know you get. But I mean, they're doing well in terms of ratings. They the number one rated show now on comedies on the late night slot.
Yeah.
But for 18 and 35 year olds, I think that's the age.
Sure.
So that's good. I mean that's good. Yeah. And I mean he's got a good set of people around him, so he'll be good.
Do you have more ambitions to be in that type of space? So if someone calls you and goes, look, you know, we want to go to that next level in that sort of late night space, whether it's in South Africa or the UK or US or anywhere, would you be open to it?
I would, that's something I would do, but I also just don't like, I haven't worked, like a 9 to 5 situation a very long time. I like my time and space. And so for me, what's important is to be able to work the, because first and foremost, I'm a stand-up. So the thing that gives me the most happiness is probably is getting up on stage and doing stand-up. So if I can't do that, I'm going to be unhappy.
Okay.
Meaning that whatever I'm doing in replacement of that, it's not gonna be fulfilling to me.
Got it.
So I gotta whatever is happening be still able to do stand-up.
So I have to go here because if you have a show that's nominated a couple times for Emmy and its ratings are amazing, what happens?
I think that because a lot of people in television in South Africa still want to own your stuff.
Okay.
So, but that wasn't our problem in this particular case. We were trying to go a certain direction and try to acquire maybe. Try to be part ownership in this thing and we were trying to go a different creative direction and the channel were trying to do something else. So we never,
your talent, not owners.
Pardon?
Where they're like, you're talent, we're owners.
Pretty much. And yeah. So we were fighting that battle of like, okay, cool. Let's try, you know, let's 40%, 10%. Can we just fight? And they're like, no. And we're just like, well, okay. Okay, that doesn't work. And then creatively, we weren't meeting, we weren't agreeing on a lot of stuff eventually, just in terms of format and timings and this, that. And we just, okay, let's try to rebuild something else and take it elsewhere. And I mean, I think the problem even now, we do have a show that exists and has a pilot, but the problem is that people just want to own stuff.
Yeah.
But then they just want to own and sit on it. It's not like they want to take it to MIPCOM and sell it to Switzerland. They just want to keep it for the sake of owning it. So it's like pointless. You know what I mean? Because you're at the Emmys and someone wants to buy the format of Late Night News. There were two guys wanted to buy the format of Late Night News, but we're like, we can't sell it to you because we don't own it. I have no motivation to sell something I don't own. I mean, there's no... Do you understand what I mean?
Exactly.
So we were like, we're going to have to pass on these sales because... there's no benefit to it. And this is what we're trying to communicate. So if you're in a space where you can benefit from what, you know what I mean? This is the economic conversation that we're constantly having.
I'm with you. So moving forward, just sort of just thinking about, you know, the role of comedy and how it can really sort of help usher society forward. You know, if you, any leader, what are some of the critical lessons a leader needs to be thinking about relative to this whole sort of like, if you're in a board meeting, right, and you are the CEO of Transnet and things are going bad, so you know a train is falling off or whatever, you know, I don't know how a train falls off, but if a train falls off, you know, how do you deal with the awkwardness both in the media as well in the boardroom?
I think, well, I've never encountered a situation like that, but I would like to think that the defensive route is not the way to go. I think sometimes I watch dudes just get defensive. And I've seen people just go, actually, you're right. We actually not doing so well, but we're working on it. And we're going to try to solve this problem. Hopefully, we'll solve it in the time frames that we've given ourselves. And I think if you're being honest with yourself, like if you can laugh at yourself, which means that you can be honest with yourself about yourself, and you can go, well, which is a very difficult thing. It took me a long time to allow people to like if you get roasted, you know, when you allow yourself to get roasted.
Yeah, I generally
hate that, but I think of late I'm like, it's always good to know the public perception of yourself.
Because that's what roasting is, really.
Right, that's what...
At the highest level, actually.
At the highest level. That's public perception of yourself. So if you're being roasted, there are reoccurring themes. And those reoccurring themes are either a perception or a truth.
Yeah.
Right? So then, if you were in a situation, in a corner like that, trains are falling off, you have to go... Like Telkom. Even if you work at Telkom, right? You have to acknowledge... Telkom sucks.
Yeah.
Like, even if you like, I'm the PR person, you gotta go, we suck. then you do, they suck, like they suck.
Got it.
Like I'm trying to disconnect my what do you call it? My subscription or whatever they call it, like my internet. And they said, yeah, go to that pile, take a form, fill it out, and send that to our cancellation department. How bad is your business when you guys have an email to a cancellation department?
That's deep.
How many people are canceling their contracts for you to go, we're gonna have a cancellation department?
Yeah, like a whole
division. The whole division,
yeah,
that deals with people who are canceling.
So if you're the head of that division, you need to acknowledge that.
Like, you know, so there's certain companies that just suck. And you suck. That's it.
Got it. All right. And I think that's part of one of the things that I've enjoyed about your comedy is that you're pretty brash about and pretty open about letting people know when they suck. But have you found situations where, like, truth can often be like a knife? It can cut and leave people bleeding. How do you deal with that? Because people are sensitive.
Yeah. Well, that includes me. I'm also, I have a great deal of sensitivity because I'm human. I'm a human being. But my harshness is usually to civil politicians who, to a large extent, are selfish. So, and I do have the platform and the voice to say, hey, man, that's a bit selfish. I mean, you have press and stuff like that, but the press is still seen as, it's the press. It's still a thing. But if a human being, just another civilian, goes, you guys suck, and this is, I think they should be able to take it. It comes with the space. I mean, I would feel bad. I really felt bad when I was. I was hosting this the SAFTAs, and I made fun of Minnie Dlamini. I was like, I mean, this girl is.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
It wasn't even like I'll feel more bad about something like that. I was just the host, and we had a dead moment, and I just made, you know, fun of it a little bit, and that I'll feel bad about because I mean she's just a young lady doing her thing, and sure. I'm just making fun. But I won't feel bad for making fun of, I don't know, Musimai Mani or Figen Mbalulu, you know, one of the ministers. Yeah.
And when you do, and there's like, have you been in a situation where there was literally like, almost like bloodshed socially, like where you left a this.
Nah, not really. It never gets there with me. I think also like with comics, we get away with way more than what anyone else would. So if I say I've heard Mbalula say I suck on national TV, which is that's quite funny, and. But it never gets to, I think with me, it's always remained healthy banter.
Got it.
It's never accelerated to a point where I have no control of what's going on, or now lawyers have to be called, sure. or mothers have to be, hey, your son is out of control, you know, it's always.
Did you feel bad? I know you gotta go, but did you feel bad when the whole country sort of rallied around Casper, and you made a joke around him, you know, needing to fill up the dome or whatever. But did you feel bad afterwards? Like, people got behind him, and they saw this as a moment in history, and you had been giving him a hard time.
Well, I wasn't really... This is the issue of being, like, sensitive. So sometimes it's Twitter, it's open, you know. First of all, a lot of people didn't think he was going to fill up the dome.
Yeah.
I just admit, I was just vocal about it. So everyone I spoke to, people who were there, didn't think he was going to do it. And when he did it, I was like, oh, wow, this is amazing.
Did you say that on Twitter?
Yeah, I said it to him. I tagged him. I said, I didn't think you were going to do it.
Okay.
You did it. Kudos. You know, and it was that. But this is how I engage on Twitter. I call out the bullshit all the time. The reason where this starts is he was complaining about Pharrell, right? He was complaining about Pharrell. So I was like, yo, why are you complaining about Pharrell? Like, so I was, this is quite crazy. I was saying to a friend of mine, and she was saying, we were talking, and she was saying to me, she needs to make more money so she can be happy. I said, no, the money is never going to make you happy. Right? The money is not, you got to work on your happiness before the money comes. Because
yes.
When the money comes, it's not gonna make you happy. So I was going, this is what I was poking at the most. I was going, well, you're the most successful rap act in the country. Your music is selling more than anyone else. You worried about Pharrell. Who you worried about, Woolworths and Pharrell? That's what I was saying. Right, yeah, and he took it out of that context of no. I said, yo, man, it's fine. You weren't at the board meeting of Pharrell. You don't know what their strategy is. You all you saying is that they're not giving local acts an opportunity. No, local acts are supported. More people buy your music more than Pharrell's music in South Africa. I don't get the complaint. Okay. You're whinging right now, and I'm not with you. And I'm talking as a person who likes your music. And that was it, right? And then it sort of like accelerated. So people were like, he's hating. And I call out anyone who's on the bullshit. If you're on the bullshit, I get called out. That's what Twitter is.
Sure.
Someone says some bullshit, you call them out. That's sure. It.
Got it.
It's the same like what happened with Fees Must Fall.
If I had not used laughter to connect with the Pretoria audience, I would not have made the friends I made that night. Of course, I didn't accept their proposal for marriage. Sometimes I think I should have. But what I got back was something bigger. I realized by connecting with these women that it wasn't racism that created the awkwardness in the room. It was that they were expecting a woman speaker. They weren't aware that the speaker mistake that was made early in communications had been fixed. It was a mistake. But this mistake was fixed by laughter. Thank you so much, Loiso. All the best in your global work. And thank you for listening to the Brain and Brand Show. Please do subscribe, rate the show on whichever platform you're using and listening on, and do share with your friends. We'll be back.
This is CliffCentral.com.